it was a great team victory. One of, like I said, one of the best I've been around in a place where I love it when nobody says you're going to have a chance to win. I mean, there's an 11-3 team and a team that's always 8-8. You figure it out.
I don't know whether the appropriate response is snap or boom or something else, but Jeff Fisher, that's how you diss somebody. You don't do it passive-aggressively. You don't send out six ceremonial captains who happen to be the guys that you acquired in the trade that gave the opponent a quarterback who, as of now, looks like a bust, and just wait for someone to notice. You come out and hit him between the eyes. And doesn't that epitomize the Arizona Cardinals? Regardless of what's going on, regardless of who's injured, regardless of who's healthy, regardless of who the opponent is, Bruce Arians brings that team out and hits you right between the eyes. Playoff berth virtually clinched. As long as the Cowboys and the Eagles don't tie, and who knows, as crazy as this year has been, maybe they will. But if they don't, the Cardinals are in the playoff field. Amazing outcome. Amazing development. 11-3. Bruce Arians, Coach of the Year. If there was any doubt before last night, there is no doubt now. To go into St. Louis, Rams team that had outscored its opponents 72-0 over the two prior games. Drew Stanton goes out. Ryan Lindley comes in and plays well enough to get the victory. The team doesn't change its demeanor. The team does, you know, at that point, when you get down to the third quarterback, it's easy to just say, oh, well, it's not our night, it's not our year. Nope, not happening with the Cardinals, and Bruce Arians is a reason for it. And who in the hell failed to hire Bruce Arians over the years? It's easy to pick on the Bears because they hired Mark Trestman over Arians a couple of years ago, but the Bills passed on Arians. And Arians was there in plain sight for all those years as the offensive coordinator at Pittsburgh, and no one hired him. I don't even remember him being a candidate. But for the performance when Chuck Pagano developed leukemia in 2012 and Bruce Arians became the Coach of the Year as the interim head coach, but for that, maybe this guy never gets an opportunity to be an NFL head coach. And that it's bad enough that he had to wait as long as he did. It would have been criminal if this guy never would have gotten a chance. And good for the Cardinals to recognize that he was the right guy. Good for Bruce Arians to make the most out of what he has. And when you look at it, they don't have very much, but they just keep winning. And now they're in the playoff field. And they didn't need an expanded playoff field to get in. Earlier this week, Commissioner Roger Goodell acknowledged that there would be discussion soon on expanding the playoffs for 2015. And this was ready to be done earlier this year. Everything was pointing toward the league expanding the playoff field during the meetings that happened this past March in Florida. But at some point, here's what I believe happened. Somebody realized, you know what? Why in 2014 would we officially expand the playoffs for 2015? Why would we do that and then have a football season that will be played with the new rules a year away? Can you imagine what the reaction would be this year if everyone knew that the playoffs would be expanding in 2015? For the fans of the teams that would have been the seventh seed if the playoffs had been expanded. Look, anybody who's paying attention knows it's coming. It's coming, barring some sort of an upset. It's coming. But the average fan, the casual fan, the drive-by fan of the team that just barely missed getting in, that fan would have been pretty upset knowing that if it had just been next year, the team would have made it. Why is it next year? Why isn't it this year? I don't like it. It doesn't feel fair. I'm not going to follow the NFL anymore. I mean, you want to guard against that. So, look, at a time when there's been plenty of criticism of the NFL, I think we need to acknowledge that they got something right. They almost got it wrong, but they got it right by pressing pause on expanding the playoffs until March of 2015. Now watch, they won't expand the playoffs in March. I think they will. I think they were ready to last year. And if anything, what we're seeing this year, further confirmation that the playoffs should be expanded, that there are enough good playoff teams to go around, except, of course, in the NFC South. And one more point on that. People act like it's an aberration that there's a team that gets in and hosts a playoff game that has a record significantly worse than the fifth seed than the first wild card in either conference. Look, last year, the 49ers were 12-4, and they had to go to Lambeau Field when the Packers won the NFC North with an 8-7-1 record. In 2011, the Steelers were 12-4. They had to go to Denver, where the Broncos had won the AFC West with an 8-8 record. And the one example we all point to, but obviously not the only one, the 7-9 Seahawks 4 years ago hosting the 11-5 New Orleans Saints, which would make it fair for the Saints to win the NFC South just to get the other side of that coin 4 years later. And then, while expanding the playoffs, why not say that the records will be used to determine playoff seeding regardless of whether or not you've won a division? And go ahead and make division title the first tiebreaker. For example, if you win the NFC South and you have the same record as the number five seed, but the number five seed beat you, doesn't matter. You won a division, you get the edge. That's the first tiebreaker if the records are the same. Makes sense. Let's see whether or not the NFL will do it. One thing the NFL will be doing is welcoming Oregon quarterback Marcus Mariota into the fold, assuming he enters the draft. I guess he can come back for one more year. It'd be a shock at this point if he comes back. It also would be a shock if he doesn't win the Heisman Trophy Saturday night. And I was intrigued by, and I continue to be intrigued by, the connection between Mariota and Eagles coach Chip Kelly. Here's Kelly on Thursday talking to reporters about the man that Kelly recruited to attend Oregon.
I haven't got a chance to watch a full body of work from him, but anything he does numbers-wise and things like that don't surprise me. But I think it's how he handles himself, his demeanor, and all those things that really kind of set him apart. He's a special young man from that standpoint.
Risky stuff on the surface from Kelly, because technically you're not supposed to talk about a college player who has yet to be certified to enter the NFL draft, specifically an underclassman. But NFL, look, that's the rule on paper. They never bust anybody for it. Now watch, I say that, and they're going to bust Chip Kelly for it. But I can't help but wonder whether or not Chip Kelly, who has general disdain for the draft as it is, regards the whole thing as a crapshoot. And, you know, his attitude is, if you find a guy in the sixth round who ends up being a great player, you shouldn't be praised. You should be criticized for not drafting him earlier. So why not give up a bunch of draft picks if that's what it takes to move up and get the quarterback that you feel very strongly about? And there was more he said yesterday. He went on and on about what a great person, what a great player, what a great talent, what a special talent Marcus Mariota is. As the offseason unfolds and as we get closer and closer to the draft, you have to wonder what the Eagles may have up their sleeves as they consider moving up the draft board to try to get in position to get Mariota. And, of course, how they do down the stretch is going to have a lot of influence over how far they're going to have to go, because with each level that they advance in the postseason, that's farther they're going to have to move up. That's more they're going to have to move up if they decide to make a move for Marcus Mariota. But Chip Kelly may pull a Mike Ditka and basically say, do whatever it takes. Give up the whole draft to go get Marcus Mariota like Ditka did, it'll be 16 years ago, when he got Ricky Williams. Okay, when we return, we're going to talk to a guy who has been considered for the Hall of Fame. Some say he should be in. We'll give him a chance to make his case as he moves again toward another Hall of Fame vote. Former Raiders great Tim Brown joins the program from 30 Rock, where we'll be doing this thing two-way, assuming everything works. And we've already checked. Everything does work. I just don't want to jinx it. I think I may have jinxed it. Then we'll wrap things up by talking to you, assuming everything works. We think everything works. I don't want to jinx that either, but it's PFT Planet Day. We've got questions via Twitter, the best one. Gets a signed copy of Al Michaels' book, You Can't Make This Up. We'll take your calls via phone. We'll do all that after we talk to Tim Brown. We'll talk to Tim Brown after the break. Stick around. This is PFT Live. They're giving out the Heisman Trophy tomorrow night, but it was 27 years ago that our next guest was sitting there nervously awaiting the announcement of who would win the 1987 Heisman Trophy. And when they said the name, it was his name. Tim Brown, former Notre Dame great, former Oakland Raider great, joining us now from 30 Rock. Tim, how much doubt did you have sitting there that night that it was going to be your name that you heard?
Well, first of all, you didn't have to mention 27 years, man. That's hard to take. But it was a tough evening. You know, I can remember Jim Nance coming up to me saying, well, you know, if you don't win it, don't worry about it. It's a great year. I was like, oh, I didn't win it. Then James Brown came up to me and said, oh, well, you know, you deserve it. And I was like, oh, I did win it. You know, so you were really going by what everybody was saying to you. But it was a nerve-wracking night, no doubt about it.
Yeah, and you beat out fairly convincingly Don McPherson. That's a name I'd forgotten, the former Syracuse quarterback. Gordy Lockbaum, Lorenzo White, and Craig Ironhead Hayward. In hindsight, I mean, going in, you know, what level of confidence did you have based on your season? Because everybody's confident in their abilities, but it seemed pretty clear at the time, and I recall it vividly, even though it was 27 years ago, that you were the odds-on favorite. Did you feel like the odds-on favorite?
Well, you know, after the Michigan State game where I had the two punt returns, you know, I felt like I was a favorite from that point on. And I didn't get a lot of opportunities after that because people started kicking the ball away from me and doing a lot of double teaming on offense. So I didn't know. My numbers my junior year were actually a lot better than my numbers my senior year. But I guess because I was affecting the game so much, when people have to, people trying to keep the ball away from me, it ended up paying off for me in a big way.
One of the perks of winning the Heisman Trophy, you get a lifetime vote. Are you allowed to tell us who you voted for this year?
I'm not, man. I can tell you. I can tell you on Sunday, though, if you want to talk again. You know, I can let you know then. But well, they want us to keep it in.
Let's look backward then. You've been voting on it for the last 27 mm-hmm. years. Which year do you think that the rest of the voters got it the most wrong?
Well, look, Ty Detmer is a good friend and a guy who. You know, I think he's done incredible things with his life, you know, in and out of football. But that year, I really think that Rocket Ismail should have won the Heisman Trophy. The award said to the most outstanding player, and there's no doubt in anybody's mind that Rocket was the most outstanding player during that year. But Ty put up some incredible numbers, and, you know, and I can definitely see why he got the award.
Now, it's been a while. I didn't say 27 years. Well, I did now. It's been a while since you had to sweat it out for the Heisman. You're sweating it out now annually for the Hall of Fame. I look at your numbers, sixth all-time in yardage, fifth all-time in receptions, seventh all-time in receiving touchdowns. How confident are you that it's going to happen?
Well, it's not about confidence, you know. I mean, I'm sure it's going to happen one day, you know, but I want to be on this side of the earth when it does happen, you know. But at the same time, man, you know, this is a very difficult process for everybody involved. And, you know, I'm sure for the voters, it's difficult for them too. You know, so at the same time, man, you just have to ride the process out and try and, you know, ride it with as much dignity as you possibly can. And but my whole deal is trying to manage the expectations of people around me. And if I can do that, then I have a good chance of getting through this process without going up or going down too much.
How big of a challenge has that been to manage expectations of those around you?
Well, the second year I was up when the Super Bowl was in Dallas, it was tough. You know, everybody was in Dallas like, oh, yeah, they were just saving it to do it here in Dallas. And, you know, and I let myself buy into that. So it was a big emotional letdown for sure. But, you know, at the same time, man, you know, it's just incredible to be listed and, you know, one of the guys who could be in the Hall of Fame. That's just an incredible honor.
One of the realities, one of the dynamics of the Hall of Fame vote is that other players who played the same position start percolating through the pipeline. You've got guys mm-hmm. like Terrell Owens and Randy Moss coming. Does that create a greater sense of urgency that, you know, if I don't get in soon, I'm going to have to wait even longer because here comes T.O., here comes Randy Moss?
You know, I'm not looking at it that way as far as if I don't get in now, then it may be a little longer. I'm just trying to manage the process. And if it's this year, it's great. If it's 10 years from now, well, you know, I'll be a little grayer probably, a lot grayer. But it is what it is, man. But, I mean, obviously those guys had great careers, and they deserve their place in the history of the NFL. And so we'll see what happens, man. But I'm not going to, you know, I can't compare myself to what those guys did because I'm not the same kind of receiver that they were. So I think from that standpoint, you know, it's a great position to be in no matter who you are. And you just got to ride it out.
If you had a vote on the Hall of Fame and you had to choose between Moss and Terrell Owens, which guy would you pick?
Oh, boy, that's really tough because, you know, I think both of those guys sort of changed the position. You know, all of a sudden when they came in, the big receiver, the guy who was 6'3", 6'4", was now in play. Whereas before, you didn't have that type of guy playing receiver. So, you know, I think T.O. with his overall receiver abilities is probably the better receiver. You know, Randy was a great deep threat and did some incredible things. But, you know, T.O. was able to do a lot more things on the football field. So, you know, I think T.O. would get the edge. But, you know, who am I? Who am I to say, right?
Yeah, they don't give you a vote on the Hall of Fame right. once you get in, unlike the Heisman Trophy. Okay, you mentioned that they were different players than you. Who in the game today playing the receiver position reminds you the most of you?
Well, it's going to be a guy that runs the intermediate routes, runs the short routes, and, you know, will go deep every once in a while. But most importantly, he has the ability to make something happen once he catches the ball. So you look at guys like Sammy Watkins, who I believe is just going to be an incredible player. You look at Whitten from Marcus Whitten from at Pittsburgh, you know, another guy who I think is going to be great. Cooks down in New Orleans, you know, and so, you know, you have a lot of people out there, a lot of young guys out there who are getting it done, and they're not the kind that are going to go and jump on top of somebody's head and score a touchdown. They're going to do it the old-fashioned way by catching the ball, making somebody miss, and getting the ball in the end zone.
Your old team, the Raiders, need plenty of young guys who can get things done. What do you think ultimately needs to happen to turn the team around? Is it coaching? Is it talent? Is it front office? Is it a combination of the three?
Yeah, you know, I think everybody needs to step their game up for sure. And, you know, Sparano has done a great job with the Raiders. You know, the record is not indicating that. But, you know, from what I'm hearing from the guys, you know, they love playing for this guy and wish he could stay around longer. Maybe not in the head coaching position, but, you know, be on the team for sure. But I think the Raiders have to go and attract a big-time coach. You know, maybe they can get one of these guys who won Super Bowls and sitting in the studios. Maybe they can get one of these guys to come out of retirement and play some ball. So, but I think that's vitally important for this team. And I think with that, I think you'll be able to attract more talent to help this football team out.
If owner Mark Davis were to call you up and say, "Who should I hire to be the head coach?" Who would you say?
Oh, boy, that would be tough. You know, I think Holmgren would be a great choice, you know, but I think everybody's overall choice would be John Gruden at this point, simply because of his relationship with Raider Nation and his relationship with the Raiders organization. I think at this particular point, he would be the right man for the job. But I know him well enough to know that he loves his job on Monday night. So it's going to be a tough, tough deal trying to pull him away from that.
One of the keys will be having a quarterback in place if you're going to lure a coach. Usually a team that has a coaching vacancy doesn't have a very good quarterback. What's been your take on Derek Carr, the rookie that they picked in the second round this year?
Well, I think Derek has played great. You know, I think he has played as great as he could possibly play with what's been going on. So certainly I think he needs some more talent around him. The best thing about a rookie player is they become second-year players. So that means he's only going to get better. And if he can get through the rest of this year without any major injuries, and he'll be able to look back on this as a really good learning experience for him and just be able to move on in a very positive way. So I think there are some things he can definitely improve on. But at the same time, I think with everything that's going on there, he's done an incredible job.
Who was the best quarterback you ever played with in the NFL?
The best pure passer I played with was, without a doubt, Jeff George. I mean, Jeff had an incredible arm and the ability to put the ball wherever you want it. But I don't think there's any doubt that Rich Gannon probably was the best overall. You know, Steve Berline was my boy, and Jeff Hotstetler, we had some great years together. But the things that we were able to do together with Rich Gannon, he probably was the best. He was definitely the smartest quarterback I ever played with. The guy knew what everybody was doing on the field, including the officials. So he was great to play with.
Where are you on greatest receiver of all time? Most people say Jerry Rice. Guys like Randy Moss would say themselves. Who do you say the greatest receiver of all time is?
Well, there will never be another player who would have the longevity, who would have the Super Bowls, and would have all the numbers like Jerry Rice. So I you can say that you're better than Jerry Rice, but that's just ridiculous because the numbers certainly don't prove that out. Jerry will go down in history. It's not only the best player in the league, but I believe he will go down. I mean, best receiver in the league, but I believe he will go down in history as one of the best players in the history of the game. So, you know, I know these young guys want to take that title away from him, but you got to put in the 20 years. You got to put in the three Super Bowls, and you got to get all these numbers up there that you guys are putting up right now. And I don't think anybody would be able to do that.
When you arrived at the Raiders in 1988, they were in L.A. Then they moved to Oakland. Now they may move back to L.A. Do you think they will? Do you think they should?
I think they should stay in Oakland if at all possible. And I know that's what the team is trying to do. They're trying to work out a deal to stay there. But it's tough because the city of Oakland doesn't have the funds to get it done. And it seems like to everybody that really L.A. is trying to woo any team. They don't care who they get down there. They just want a team. And so that may make it very difficult for them to go there. I tell you, the wild card here, I believe, is San Antonio. I know people don't want to hear that. But from what I'm hearing, the package that San Antonio put on the table was far better than any package they could have ever imagined. So financially, the best thing for the team may be to go to San Antonio. I know that would hurt a lot of Raider fans in California, but at the same time, this team has to find a home. And if Oakland and L.A. can't get it done, then maybe San Antonio is the place.
But do you like the sound of that, San Antonio Raiders? That sounds like something from a different football league.
Yeah. It definitely sounds like a Arena Ball 2 or something. But, I think this team has to look out for what's best for the players and for the organization. And certainly the Raiders are always going to try and look out for Raider Nation as much as possible. But at some point, it just gets to the point where you have to make a great financial decision. And that decision may be going down to San Antonio in order to get the stadium that you want and the facilities that your practice facilities that you want. That just may be the best thing to do. So I know Mark Davis, that's the last thing he wants to do, but we'll have to see how this thing works out.
Hey, before I let you go, Tim, talk about your book, The Making of a Man, based on your experiences on and off the field.
Yeah. We wanted to put something out there, man, that was hopefully helpful to other young players, young athletes, a young man around the country, and maybe even some old men around the country who may need some help. So, just some of the things that I went through in my late 20s and throughout my career, the end of my career and through retirement, we wanted to put those things on paper here in hopes that it would help somebody out. So not trying to do a Tim Brown how to do it type book, but really just trying to remind people what's really important and knowing that there's a higher calling for all of us, and catching footballs and doing sports shows is not what this thing is all about. We have a higher calling to do greater things.
Well, you've done great things in your life. Heisman Trophy winner, future Hall of Famer. Hopefully both of us are on the right side of the ground when that happens. And we hope to talk to you again soon. Thanks for coming in, Tim.
Hey, thanks, man. Appreciate the time.
There he is, Tim Brown, 87 Heisman winner, future Hall of Famer, all-time Raiders great receiver. When we come back, we're going to talk to you. You can ask any question you want, and I'll answer it. We'll ask your questions via Twitter, and I'll answer them. And the best question gets a copy of Al Michaels' book, signed, not by me, by Al. We already have our winner picked. We'll unveil it when we come back. Pick up your cell phone device, dial 888-237-5269. We'll be right back. This is PFT Live. Oh, it's PFT Planet Time. We do it most Fridays. Every Friday if we can. Every Friday we have a show, except when we don't. We're doing it today, and the best question via Twitter gets a signed copy of Al Michaels' book, You Can't Make This Up. So let's see who's up first. First question as I rifle through my documents. At A Red Zone Alk, loyal friend of the program. Dear Santa, I've been a good boy all year, reading Pro Football Talk every day. Can I have a book for Christmas? Well, A Red Zone Alk, unfortunately, you don't get today's copy of Al Michaels' book, but we encourage you to submit a question, A Red Zone Alk, next week. Any question you choose. We have one more book to give away. And of course, next week is a lot closer to Christmas than this week. Next up, let's go to the phone lines. Jared in Baltimore, you're on PFT Live. What's up, Jared?
Hey, what's going on? Mike, I haven't called in for a while.
We missed you.
Right. But I've been seeing, like, everybody asking, like, what's their expectations for Manziel this weekend. Like, stats-wise, like, breaking it down to every little, like, piece, how many carries getting for how many yards. Like, it's crazy. It's just, like, it's really, like, the Tebow effect. But, like, he literally, you can throw, though, and he's much better than Tebow. So I don't want anybody ever comparing him to Tebow. But, I mean, what's your expectations? Like, since everybody's doing it, what stat lines would you give him when you think they're going to come out with a win?
Well, And thank you for the call. And you're right, there is a mania around Manziel that reminds you of the Tebow effect. But Manziel, a better quarterback, a better passer. And the real question is, how do they balance his instincts against the Kyle Shanahan offense, which requires a quarterback to do things a very specific way? Rex Grossman, who has played for years in the Kyle Shanahan offense, was with the Browns earlier this year. He said a few years ago, Kyle wants you to do everything his way. The way you make your drops, the way you make your reads, it's all very specific, it's all very detailed, it's all predetermined, and that's anything but Manziel's style. Kyle Shanahan talked yesterday with reporters about trying to balance that, and I don't think there's any expectation about what's going to happen other than they're going to put together a game plan that they believe will give Manziel a chance to be successful. And I expect to see some running. I expect to see more running, not by design, but when things break down, Manziel's instincts are going to kick in, because any amount of coaching you get, it's all going to go back to instinct when you feel like you're in a tough spot. And that reminds me of Tebow. Remember all the talk, Tebow's changing his passing motion. Look, when you're in the middle of the stuff, you revert back to your instincts. And I think that's what we're going to see out of Manziel. I also think he's going to be better the first couple weeks because there isn't film out there. Yeah, there's film of him in the preseason. There's film of him against the Bills. But there isn't film of Manziel with a game plan that is being implemented as the starting quarterback. And typically you will see an artificial bump early on, and then the rest of the league will catch up. And then can you overcome whatever the defense does once the defense sees how the quarterback, how the head coach, how the offensive coordinator are going to attack. So it's going to be one of the most interesting storylines of the season with real playoff implications. And, you know, the Bengals lost to the Browns by 21 when Brian Hoyer was the quarterback. The Browns need this one desperately. The Bengals do too. It's one of the great games of the weekend. But thanks again for the call, Jared. Don't stay away so long next time. All right, Twitter question from at Rock9449. Which quarterback has a better chance of turning it around long-term, RG3 or Colin Kaepernick? I'm going to say Kaepernick for a couple of reasons. First, Kaepernick hasn't had the injury issues. And I believe that if Kaepernick were able to run as frequently as we see him run when the 49ers make it to the postseason, I think he could be a more effective quarterback week in and week out. Now, the problem there is you're opening up the possibility of injuries being inflicted upon Colin Kaepernick. But that doesn't stop Russell Wilson. So if you're confident you can keep Kaepernick healthy, why are you trying to force a square peg into a round hole and make this guy be a pocket passer? Give him that option to take off and run. That's going to be the biggest challenge for the next head coach, assuming the next head coach wants Colin Kaepernick. Remember, that contract gives the 49ers until April 1 of each of the next 5 years to decide whether or not they can upgrade at the position and save the money that they will be paying to Colin Kaepernick if they don't move on from Kaepernick, who looked great in 2012, looked great in the postseason in 2012, looked great in the postseason in 2013. But last regular season, this regular season, average, I think, is the fair label. Maybe they need to let him run more in the regular season like he does in the postseason, and he'd be more effective, be more dynamic. And I think he's in a better position between himself and RG3 to get back to being what we've seen in the not-too-distant past. Go back to the phone lines. Leo in Wisconsin, you're on PFT Live. How's it going, Leo?
Hey, Mike. I just want to talk about the clown show in Chicago known as the Chicago Bears. I personally blamed the entire season on Jay Cutler. He has totally underperformed. He's done nothing. He hasn't won anything in his life, and I'm so thankful that Aaron Cromer called him out for it, but Cutler should be apologizing to the fans. Cromer should not be apologizing to Cutler. It's just a disaster. I mean, what's your take on what's the realistic possibility of us cutting ties with Cutler?
Well, great question, great call, and I appreciate the call in. And it's funny, he called it a clown show. If Tom Curran were on the show, he might call it a different kind of show. But we'll leave it to your imagination as to what Tom might say and how colorfully he might say it. And hopefully he won't say it as of January 5 when we're on FCC-regulated airwaves. But with Cutler, you know, this is the strongest argument in favor of contract structures for quarterbacks that give teams year-to-year flexibility. Andy Dalton did a contract that gives the Bengals year-to-year flexibility. Kaepernick's contract gives the 49ers year-to-year flexibility. The contract that the Bears gave to Cutler, $54 million guaranteed over 3 years. Now, they can walk away from it after this year, but he's walking out the door with $38 million guaranteed, $22.5 million already in hand. Same thing for 2014, 2015, wait, 26, one of these years. 2016, they could pull the plug then. He'd still have $48 million in hand, fully guaranteed that he walks away with. So what do you do? And do you hire a new coach who may not want anything to do with Jay Cutler? We've seen this movie before. In Denver, Josh McDaniels becomes the head coach, first order of business, run off Jay Cutler. So could a trade be something that happens? Would someone want Jay Cutler? Is there a coach out there that thinks, I can turn around Jay Cutler? I mean, the reality is there aren't enough good quarterbacks to go around, which is ultimately why the Bears gave him so much money. Now, did they have to give him that much? Maybe they did, because the alternative was use the franchise tag, which would have been at $17 million. So now they'd be facing paying him big money or giving him a 20% raise over what he would have made this year. But you know what? Based on how he played in 2014, maybe you do go elsewhere in 2015 and you've got greater flexibility. And then there's the reality that maybe he would have played better this year if it was a contract year. And maybe Jay Cutler is the latest player to, once he gets that huge payday, take his foot off the gas and no longer be the guy that earned that big payday. Another Twitter question from one of our regulars, C. Crawl. With the Rams stadium only 50 to 60% filled last night, has the fan base already accepted the team is moving? I'm not ready to say that it's because the team is moving. I think the Rams, over the past several years, have been playing in front of less than capacity crowds on a regular basis. I believe, and the Rams won't comment on this, I believe they're taking full advantage of the rule that allows them to sell only 85% of the non-premium seats and still declare the game to be sold out and televised locally. And none of the Rams games have been blacked out. No games have been blacked out anywhere at all this year. But I also believe Stan Kroenke, the owner of the team, is paying for whatever the shortfall is. You've got the 85% floor now. Well, everything under that, to get to 85%, you got to pay 34 cents on the dollar for those tickets. I think there's been a lot of tickets that Stan Kroenke has been buying at 34 cents on the dollar, just based on the images we see. Unless they got a lot of no-shows or a lot of people milling around the concourse area, they got a lot of people who aren't buying tickets, and could be the owner is buying plenty of tickets to keep those games on TV. And I don't think it's because of a potential move. I think it's evidence to support a potential move. This isn't a new dynamic in St. Louis. Another call, another old friend, John in Portland. You're on PFT Live. John, how are you?
I'm doing well, thank you. It's been a while. My question, Ahmad Brooks is a pretty good outside linebacker for the 49ers, but they have Alden Smith and they have Aaron Lynch. And Aaron Lynch is on a cheap contract, and Ahmad Brooks is not as good as Alden Smith. And he's also kind of in the doghouse with Vic Fangio. I think the 49ers are going to trade him. What do you think is going to happen to him next year?
Well, and thank you for the call. It's a great question. Remember, there was a report from Jay Glazer of Fox that the 49ers were trying to trade Ahmad Brooks before the trade deadline. It didn't work out, and the denials from the organization were far less than convincing. Imagine that. I'm not picking on the 49ers, just kind of how it goes. Whenever someone is, you know, exposed as planning to do something that they were going to do, the denials typically aren't very convincing. And with Lynch, with Alden Smith, and with Brooks due, I think it's like $7.5 million next year. I think he either gets traded or he just gets cut. That could be it. Why trade for his contract? If he had a great contract, then you'd be willing to trade for him. Why not just wait and sign him as a free agent? I think that's what's going to happen. I think Brooks is going to get cut. He's going to be available, and someone will sign him. Next up, and I don't know. Maybe we'll get a soundboard for the new show when we go to 3 hours. If I had a soundboard and it had a drum roll, I'd hit the drum roll, because Kenneth K wins this week's copy, signed copy of Al Michaels' You Can't Make This Up, for this question, which is something I hadn't thought of, but is an excellent point. And again, there are many things that I haven't thought of that are excellent points. But this is the one that's in front of me right now. Would the Cardinals be the biggest underdog first seed ever? Consider this. As it stands right now, the Cardinals, if they do make it to the number one seed, that necessarily means the Seahawks would be the number five seed most likely. Let's say the Seahawks are rolling into Arizona in the divisional round after Arizona gets a week off and is the number one seed waiting for the Seahawks to show up again. The line for next Sunday's game, before Drew Stanton got hurt, was Seattle -7, 6.5. Seattle -6.5. Now, assuming that they'll put a line on this game, and they probably won't until we know what's up with Drew Stanton, and frankly, we could know now. The MRI was going to be done earlier this morning. I'll check out Twitter, and we may be posting on it, maybe making a few phone calls to see what we know. It didn't sound good if you read between the lines, so it looks like it's going to be Ryan Lindley. Does it go to minus 10? And it probably would be lower than that, than a regular season game, especially if the Cardinals win. Because let's face it, if the Cardinals don't win, chances of being the number one seed plummet. But they're going to be the underdogs if the Seahawks are rolling in to Arizona in the divisional round. And I don't know, maybe they wouldn't be the underdogs if it's Dallas or Philly. But if it's Seattle, I think it's going to be the only – I can't remember a time that the number one seed was an underdog. We'll have to take on that research project. But that's an intriguing question. Kenneth Kay, congratulations. We'll get in touch with you via Twitter. And you get this week's copy of Al Michaels' book, signed by the author. You can't make this up. Next week, we're going to give out one more. And hey, Red Zone Alec, make sure you ask a question next week. I have a feeling it's going to be a really good question. I have a feeling some of you will be joining us tonight on NBCSN for Pro Football Talk, a full hour to get you ready for Week 15. I'm not going to say I can't believe it's already Week 15, but I can't believe it's already Week 15, so I said it. It's already Week 15. A lot of great stuff with significant playoff implications coming up. We'll get you ready for that. We'll look back on Thursday night's game. We'll talk about whatever else is going on in the NFL. And that's what we do all the time at ProFootballTalk.com. So check us out there all weekend long. See you back here on Monday. Of course, when I say that on Friday, back here means Connecticut, so it's not really here. But I screw that up all the time. You should be used to it by now. See you Monday.